This is Art Moves. Art Moves is a series of curated conversations at the intersection of art, innovation, and social justice. Each week, we'll be talking with the innovative thinkers and doers who are forging new ground in the creative arts while redefining what it means to be creative. I'm Tony Williams.
And I'm Eli Kislansky, and we're here with our co-host, Dr. Darrell Cooper.
So happy that you're with us, Dr. Darrell Cooper.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on again.
And we're delighted to have Eddie Torres here with us. And Eddie is the president and CEO of Grantmakers in the Arts, a phenomenal organization that has great services and wonderful conferences. Something that you can really, you know, and as arts leaders, I guess we could call ourselves
sure.
that.
And you're, but also you've been, you have firsthand knowledge of
exactly.
That,
right? I've been to the conference and it was, it's fantastic. The people that you meet, the content, but anyway, enough about that and more about Eddie. So Eddie, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
Now, we're going to start, I guess, with a question that we're hoping, I'm sure you'll certainly be comfortable answering this. What is it like to be the first Latinx president of GIA, of GIA? I think that's what you call it, GIA.
Yeah, thank you. I'm really excited to assume the presidency. I've been president now for about 5 years, and I'm coming over to the organization having been with the government of the city of New York. I was deputy commissioner for cultural affairs and
wow.
yes. worked for the Rockefeller mm-hmm. Foundation and the Ford Foundation.
So you've been in the philanthropy space on the other side, so to speak.
Exactly.
On the other
exactly.
side.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. But I've also been on the asking side. I mean, the first decade of my career I was spent at Bronx Council on the Arts. I started as, you know, a 22-year-old college student, and it changed my life. Working in community arts absolutely changed my life. I was born and raised in the South Bronx. You know, my family were all Puerto Rican, and to recognize that there were arts organizations in neighborhoods like the South Bronx that not only wanted to reach and engage their neighbors and their community members, but would also give an opportunity to a college student and cultivate him throughout his career for a decade. I mean, that absolutely not only changed my life, but it really changed my heart.
Let's go back to 2015, you know, when you rolled out the New York City Cultural Plan.
Mm-hmm.
And now, of course, Grantmakers of the Arts has this racial equity statement. Share with us that process and then what you were able to take from that that's going to make a difference in this space.
Well, I mean, with the cultural plan, we had a really great opportunity to, for the first time, articulate a goal for supporting arts and culture using taxpayer dollars that we'd never really had before.
Such an important project, by the way.
Oh, thank you.
It's also, mm-hmm. think about, given the scale of what is it? It's in the billions, right?
Oh, yes, yes. It was, it's...
What's the size of it?
At the time, it was around $200 million a year. And this was going back about a good 6 years or something. That's including capital expense. So some of that is bonds as opposed to direct taxpayer dollars. But, you know, you got to keep in mind, you know, when these agencies, so many of these public agencies were first set up to support arts and culture in their city. They were set up to establish institutions for the first time. You know, these were oftentimes, you know, cities that were still relatively new in the grand arc of human history. And they were basically trying to put themselves on the world map for the first time when this was still a young country. And their model for a world-class city was a European city.
Mm-hmm. Exactly, right.
So mm-hmm. that meant, you know, supporting European cultural forms, mm-hmm. you know, and that's what institution mm-hmm. building mm-hmm. meant.
Yeah, right.
It meant, you know, supporting what was essentially a cultural hierarchy with Western Europe at the top as kind of the apex of what culture was, and everything else became subservient to it.
Absolutely.
And this went unspoken for generations, you know, but it was also internalized that, you know, a group of people had culture and other people didn't have culture.
Mm.
you know? And that is already a value statement. So when we had the opportunity to create the first cultural plan for the city of New York, it was really important for us that we were out in neighborhoods talking to everyday folks. We set up tables at, you know, fairs. We set up tables at places where, I mean, the city has to do a lot of public engagement around housing plans, zoning plans, et cetera, where you're talking to folks who are just trying to live their lives. And we would set up tables and say, hey, you know, we're the agency that supports arts and culture. What's important to you, you know? And so it gave us an opportunity to say, look, strategically, we have to invest more in our neighborhoods. You know, the last time we actually set the place up, we set it up to support institutions as though these buildings were the point of supporting arts and culture. And now we have an opportunity to say, these people are the point of supporting arts and culture. And that was a unique opportunity. We were really excited about that.
Wow. GIA has made a strategic decision to foreground racial equity in our work for several reasons. Share with us what those reasons are.
Yeah, I mean, you know, when it comes to racial equity, we like to say that, you know, we are not race exclusive, but we are race explicit. Mm. Because we do think that, you know, when you look at social justice challenges, that race here in America is really foundational, you know? And oftentimes we'll get folks who'll say to us, well, how about this? How about that? You know? And the fact of the matter is, this and that are important too. But, you know, we think that there is basically three big things, you know. One is, when you look at oppressed communities, even in those oppressed communities, the racialized communities have worse social outcomes, you know, one. Two, when you look at efforts in the past to bunch up race with other things, race winds up receding into the background.
Absolutely.
You know? And then three, we actually maintain that race was created in America to keep oppressed folks separate, you know? When you look at, for instance, public benefits, you know, whether it's food stamps or welfare, you know, statistically, the primary recipients of those benefits are poor white folks, right?
Yes.
Now, we think that's important. Poor white folks deserve those benefits, right? Anybody that's poor deserves those benefits. But when you realize how racialized the public narrative about public benefits is,
you actually get folks,
and then this has been quantified, studies have been done on this, you actually get the folks who are primarily the beneficiaries of those benefits to oppose them. Mm-hmm. Right? You get this, like, for instance, with affirmative action. The first few decades of affirmative action, originally affirmative action was just created to impact racialized people.
Right.
Then gender was added to it. Right. Now, gender being added to it, I actually think is perfectly rational. Women make 80 cents on the dollar compared to men. But that's if they're white.
Right.
If they're black, it's about 65 cents on the dollar. Right. If they're Latina, it's about 60 cents on the dollar. Right. And for the first couple of decades, affirmative action primarily helped white women.
Yes, it did.
Mm-hmm. Right. Oh. Now, white women deserve affirmative action. 80 cents on the dollar is ridiculous. But statistically, the group most likely to oppose affirmative action are white women. Mm-hmm. Because in the public narrative, it's been racialized as a giveaway for people of color and not other groups. That's not statistically true. That's not statistically true of affirmative action, of public benefits, et cetera. But the narrative is more resonant than the numbers. The narrative is more resonant than the facts. That's why narrative change is essential to racial equity and social justice.
You've been a pioneer on many different topics within arts and culture and philanthropy. You talked about your extensive career with Rockefeller and Ford and the Bronx Council on the Arts. You've been described as having the courage to move important racial equity changes through systemic levers. And, you know, I followed in behind you shortly at Cultural Affairs. And I would have to say that a lot of the work that you did there inspired me to, one, want to come, but also to then stay. But this courage that you have to move through the spaces that way, where did this courage start to emerge? Where did it come from?
That's very kind of you. Thank you. I really appreciate that. The fact of the matter is I have one skill, and that is the ability to recognize who in the world is smarter and more talented than I am and surround myself with them. So I've actually been very, very lucky throughout my life to just be in a constant state of learning. Being a lifelong learner is humbling, and it requires humility. But it's the only way that I can move through the world. I do not have the answers. I just surround myself with people, whether they're on the GIA team or the people who have been my mentors throughout my career. Bill Aguado, Roberta Uno, I could go on and on. Nick Turner, I could go on and on. Yeah, mm-hmm. these are the people who have changed my life. And honestly, I go, okay, what are they thinking about? What are they talking about? What are they doing? And quite frankly, particularly now in my current role with the GIA team, how can I facilitate their doing the work that is so important as to move that forward? You know, our vice president is the one who came to me with the idea of your being one of the editors on the GIA Reader. And
thank you for that.
Yeah. And you know, we said, fantastic. You know, this is obviously a smart, talented person who is going to make positive change in our field. Let's give him the runway he needs.
You're listening to Art Moves on WNYE 91.5 FM. We're talking to the fascinating and informative Eddie Torres. And I'm sitting here listening to your conversation about stuff. And this thought came to mind that in some ways, GIA is like this, almost like a cultural secret weapon. You know, because a lot of ways it has the research for funders. And that, you know, we, as we know, research and numbers of powers, regardless of what some people say. And, I think one of the challenges, I think I'm sure you've found this yourself, especially for funding agencies and recipients, is how do you measure impact? Because impact to a large extent is anecdotal, you know, what people say about it, but it's not really quantified or qualified with empirical data of some kind.
Yeah.
So could you talk a little bit about that and how you think you have any ideas or how do you get that kind of information?
Yeah, you know, we're literally going through the data now of a member survey that we just conducted and that we've been conducting over the past few years, looking at changes to practice since 2020, changes to grant making practice. And what we're seeing year in, year out is improvement among our members in terms of increasingly supporting BIPOC organizations and artists, increasingly giving general operating support. And historically, arts and culture funders, they are as project and program fetishizing as funders generally tend to be.
Right.
But they're generally, historically, they've been better than the larger field. The larger field has historically hovered around 16%. The larger grant-making field has historically hovered around 16% of their funding going to general operating support, whereas historically, arts funders have granted around 24% of their funding being general operating support. But that's been growing since 2020. That's been increasing. The flexibility has been increasing. The equity has been increasing. And that's quantified. Among our members, it's quantified. Mm-hmm. So that's fantastic. You know, with that said, there's not a lot that is quantifying this out in the world. And so, for instance, we're part of a collaborative project with Doris Duke Charitable Foundation mm-hmm. and a few other foundations, the Racial Equity Coding Project, where we're basically working with grant makers so that they can increasingly track improvements in their grant making when it comes to equity. Specifically, to what extent is your funding by, for, and about communities of color?
You know, I'm so glad you brought up the Racial Equity Coding Project, because this really is a tangible way that organizations are starting to measure impact. Also, kind of thinking about impact, you know, GIA has this incredible saying that I love, and it's solidarity not charity, you know, because, you know, when we think about philanthropy, but could you tell us a little bit more about, you know, how this ethos developed at GIA and then also how the organization is putting this to practice and not just in theory?
Yeah, I mean, the solidarity economy stuff, I mean, I was lucky enough to be exposed to this. This is a couple of jumps back when I was at Rockefeller. And it was one of those moments where, you know, again, the arts were such an introduction to so many broader social phenomena. So the solidarity economy is basically the cooperative economy, and there's different terms for it, but basically cooperative ownership of work, of labor and the benefits of that labor. And, you know, we experience it, you know, in our day-to-day lives through, you know, food co-ops and community lands trusts and things like that. But, you know, it's been something that's actually been pioneered by artists historically. The oldest native cooperative was pioneered by artists and culture bearers. The oldest non-extractive venture capital firm, pioneered by artists. The first democratic investment fund, pioneered by artists. And, you know, we've had a certain amount of interest from our members for some time about this. We commissioned, again, a couple of artists to do a study of what is out there in the world. And we began having them get together with our members and with artists to share the needs that the artists have in the world when it comes to this. And it's something that is of increasing interest to our members. And so we're really excited about that. We want it to become something that's of increasing investment to our members.
And I guess that is the question. How are you able to align the work that you're doing with outcomes?
Our organizing network is United Philanthropy Forum. But, you know, so many of us have come to decide, and again, this is me learning from people who are smarter and more talented than me, come to decide that we have to move from philanthropy serving to philanthropy mobilizing.
Interesting.
Know? Like among the most popular things we do are the Racial Equity and Arts Funding Workshop, right? And also the Pro BIPOC Arts Funding Workshops. And these, you know, sell out like that. I mean, these are, you know, they range from about 12 hours is probably the shortest one we have, not all at once, in 3-hour chunks, you know, where we basically provide a mix of training and peer support to help people increasingly come to understand where are their practices coming from. These practices we've inherited largely from like the 1800s. what impacts are they having? You know, you look at your largest white theater in America, its operating budget is about $60 million. Your largest black theater in America, its annual operating budget is like $5 million.
Yeah,
you know?
Right.
Right. You know, and what are, you know, what we like to call in our capitalization workshops, what are the pretty bad best practices? You know, the practices that are, you know, the requirement for a match, you know, which basically means do you have access to money?
Right.
You know, the idea that you shouldn't have a surplus at the end of the year, you know, that you should be budgeting to zero. These are all outdated practices that keep us all in poverty.
So how are you going to advocate for this? I mean, or can you advocate for this? Because I definitely see an advocacy role here.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, you know, we do two forms of advocacy. You know, on one hand, well, I guess three when you think about it. On one hand, we're advocating for changes to grant-making practice, right? On the other hand, we're also advocating for funders to support, literally support advocacy, for funders to make grants that support organizations and artists to advocate for changes to government policies. And we ourselves advocate for changes to government policies, right? While, you know, we have historically been folks who advocate for changes to grant makers' practices, right? Philanthropy is such a small part of the money that serves and supports oppressed communities, right? Government money is really the where you can find scale. So we are literally not just advocating, and I mean like going to Capitol Hill, you know, Grantmakers in the Arts shows up at Capitol Hill, and we advocate to our legislators, not just for more support for the arts, not just more support for arts and education, but we're advocating for portable benefits for gig workers, right? Right now, if you're not working a full-time job, you don't have access to retirement savings, unemployment insurance, health insurance, et cetera.
And we saw that through COVID. We saw all of that through COVID.
Right.
They were the hardest one of the hardest hits, weren't they?
Yes.
And that is a relic, that's a racist relic from when we decided to set up social safety nets, and we decided we didn't want Black folks to receive those. And so we decided to exempt certain professions from receiving benefits. And we decided that those benefits would only be tied to employment. You only got those if you had a job, and you only got them through that job, right? About 30% of the workforce are gig workers, and we're all gig workers at some point.
Yes.
We believe benefits should be set up that are independent of employment, that are independent
Absolutely.
Of that position, you know? And there are other policies like this that we think, one, are essential for artists to be able to survive and thrive. But we also think that artists are workers and workers are workers, and they need to survive and thrive. So that is also an element of our strategy.
You're listening to Art Moves on WNYE 91.5 FM. And we are talking to Eddie Torres. And again, wow, this is just chocked full with really great information.
Yeah, no, it's interesting to hear about this change in philosophical change in philanthropy to a large extent. There's a parallel in the museum world because, like, especially science centers, people like that, you know, their mantra was to raise awareness. Mm. This is like, you know, being a kid from Brooklyn, it's a little like pissing in the wind. But so, you know, it's interesting because what's happening on the philanthropic side, there is a demand. I saw this in Europe, too, for them to up their game.
Sure.
Especially like a little bit like, you know, especially with climate and things like that. It's a little bit like feeling while Rome burns. So,
yeah.
But could you speak a little bit more about how that's about the shift that you're talking about?
Yeah. I mean, I think that. Right now, the field is really well positioned to place themselves into a larger context. You know, when you consider the role that, take a look at, for instance, just access to the arts, right? Most of us begin to get that in school, you know, and the correlation between the extent to which your school is resourced and the extent to which your school has access to the arts is completely tied up in our tax policy, which is completely tied up in our historical housing policy, right? So when you ultimately want your you know, public to have arts access, you inherently have to look at where you exist in the larger social structure, right? Because you got to look at your tax system, you got to look at your housing system, that's going to connect to your school system, which will inevitably, unfortunately, in contemporary America, connect to the police, the courts, the prisons, which also connects to your employment system. So we're all part of interdependent systems.
Absolutely.
And we have to recognize that. I think that's inherent to transforming the field of arts philanthropy and arts funding.
What really is the role of philanthropy in 2023 and moving forward now that, you know, it's like, you know, you can't unring the bell, and the bell has been rung.
Right.
And Gia is a really big part of that.
Thank you. Yeah, no, I think it's a great moment. You know, legislation just got introduced by Senators Langford and Coons. I might have gotten that wrong. Senator Lankman and Coons. Yeah. The Charitable Act, right? And the Charitable Act basically establishes a universal charitable deduction. This is important because right now, our tax system has historically been set up to incent giving as long as it's a large amount. So essentially, you get a tax break for giving as long as you're rich, essentially.
Right. The rest of, right, right.
You know? And
so there's a threshold number, is
exactly, exactly, mm-hmm. exactly. And so what we're basically saying is, you know, everybody has to be rewarded for giving, because everybody
Absolutely.
Does give. I mean, statistically, poor and middle-class people give a far bigger percentage of their assets to charity than wealthy people do. They just don't get any benefits for it, right?
Yeah.
And ultimately, until we recognize that everyday people are in fact philanthropists, do in fact give, whether it's through their money, their time, their sweat, etc., we're going to have the same system set up. And so this is just one piece of legislation we're excited about, but we think it is an element of changing the public narrative about giving and who deserves reward for giving.
As we end this really robust discussion, what are your feelings about what is coming? You know, what is coming? This idea of shifting the narrative, that's going to take us some time, right?
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
But what else can we do, or what else is being done in this space?
Well, you know, I think that the most important thing, you know, when we think about what is coming, is stop and be explicit about what we think our time horizon is. You know, there's been great studies of how effective conservative philanthropy has been, and conservative philanthropy does a couple of things really effectively. One is it doesn't spend much time patting itself on the back. I bet you can't name most conservative philanthropies, right?
Right.
Because they don't do the big flashy annual report, et cetera, right? So they're good, inexplicably, they're good at humility. But they're also really good at time horizons. They recognize that change will take place over a long time, and it'll only be effective if you invest for the long haul. You know, if you look at, you know, I need these actors to succeed, and it's going to take a long time. I'm going to give them multi-year general operating support.
Multi-year.
Right.
Multi-generational.
Multi-year, right. Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
Not
you know, I'm
year,
looking
yeah.
at generational change, and I need folks set up to win. Mm-hmm. And conservative philanthropy does that very effectively, and centrist and left-leaning philanthropy does that very poorly. The time horizon,
right.
when
Isn't
you receive a grant yeah, for 3 years and people are falling all over themselves to congratulate themselves, that is a dangerous dynamic. Don't get me wrong. Quite frankly, 3 years better than 1 year.
But still, you 3 years is sometimes not enough time.
Oh, it's definitely.
It's just not. It's not enough time to build. But, you know, well, this was an amazing
yeah.
conversation.
Oh, thank you.
You're amazing.
Thank you.
I just enjoyed this conversation so much. Thank you, Dr. Darrell Cooper, for guest hosting. And thank you, Eddie Torres.
Oh, thank you.
Art Moves is co-produced with Brick Arts Media and recorded at Brick Studio. This has been Art Moves with your host, Tony Williams.
And Eli Kaslansky, and our distinguished co-host, Dr. Darrell Cooper.
Find some art that moves you and share it with someone.